So the dust has settled on the quarterfinals of Euro 2020 and the second semi-final is set. I'm sorry, Paul McDonald, but England have been victorious over the Ukraine 4-0 tonight in Rome. Elsewhere, Denmark beating the Czech Republic, and those two will square off for a place in the final in Wembley on the 11th of July. Stephen Drennan and Ben Jacobs sat down straight after the full-time whistle in Rome to talk all things England against the Ukraine and, of course, that Denmark victory as well here on Why Football Happens.
I know I'm going to be a bit more exuberant than you because there is that English bias, but surely even to the neutral, that was a joy to watch.
I mean, I'm going to play the grumpy old man trying to keep everyone's feet in the ground rule at some point. You can only beat what's in front of you, and to beat it 4-0 in a quarter final, that's impressive. I would say I don't think it ever felt like a 4-0 game. I noticed that basically England converted all of the big chances they created, and it was the same in the last game against Germany. They created the two big chances, scored them both. And I remember saying in one of the other podcasts, I think it was with Spain, I was saying that you can't keep missing big chances, but the inverse is true as well. You can't just keep scoring them. And if you're scoring all the ones you create, it maybe creates a feeling that you're a lot better than you are. But and that would be my concern if I was England. But yeah, you can't really be too concerned about too much after tonight.
We'll come on to the concerns in just a moment, and mine remains Jordan Pickford. And we saw one semi-moment of madness even in this game where he almost skewed a clearance leading to a consolation for Ukraine. But I think at the other end, it was obviously important and has been throughout the tournament for England to involve Harry Kane much more. And he was clinical with his chances and could have easily had a hat-trick.
Yeah, we've said it about so many teams in this tournament. Actually, we've said it about Italy with Immobile, Spain with Morata. You need your centre forward on form going into the semis and the final. And England have that now. They've got a guy that looks like he's going to score with any chance he gets. Up until today's game, I just looked at shambles up front. He gets one goal against Germany and now he's flying. And it's just amazing the difference getting a goal seems to have made.
Let's talk about two Manchester United players in Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw. Maguire really underlining his importance for the Three Lions as not just the rock at the back, but leadership qualities and able to get forwards and pinch an odd goal. And Luke Shaw, who more so really than Maguire, I think, has lit up the tournament, but unlike Maguire, hasn't had that same sort of reputation comparative to his other squad mates. And I think in this game, but in the tournament at large, Shaw's been outstanding. He's got three assists. What have you made of those two players and how important are they going forward?
I think as a footballer, it's very hard to shake a bad opinion or a bad narrative. And I think that's probably the problem Luke Shaw had carried over from that Mourinho era. And I said last season he's one of the best left backs in Europe at the moment, along with maybe Lodi at Atletico Madrid, Robertson at Liverpool. Spinazzola at this tournament's been phenomenal and has been impressive in Serie A for a while, but he struggles with injuries. So he's always been one of the best players in his position in the world whenever he's fit and on form. But it's just that I think that bad reputation is just always lingering. And as soon as you have a bad moment, it just snaps you right back to it. So I remember last season he had a bad game against Liverpool and immediately all the talk was like Robertson's proved that Luke Shaw's like not as good as he thinks he is or not as good as people say he is. And it's amazing how like you can play amazing for 20 games and then you have one bad game and it snaps you back to that bad narrative. And I think that's what happens with Luke Shaw. I think he's amazing. I think Harry Maguire's also been very impressive, considering as well that he's probably not even fit. He was struggling. He didn't play the first two games. He was struggling to train. I think he's been rested between games and not participating too much in training. So, I mean, this is a half-fit Harry Maguire. So, yeah, I was actually surprised he stayed on the pitch. I thought, like, given all of that with his injuries and the fact he's on a yellow card, it just seemed like a mad risk to leave him on the pitch. Like, he accidentally trips someone, he gets a yellow card, and he misses the semis. Just didn't seem sensible to leave him on. There you go.
No, absolutely. And I think that luckily England are not in a position where they'll be without him. But what we have seen over the course, particularly of the last two games, Germany and Ukraine, is that depth of the England squad. So I suppose the first part of Euro 2020 was all about a debate over who's the starting 11. And there was quite a lot of contention about the first 11 that Gareth Southgate put out. And then because Scotland was England's poorest performance, there was even more debate about the team. And there's kind of Camp Sancho, why isn't he starting? And then everyone was quite impressed by Saka and Bellingham. And then there's obviously Camp Grealish as well. And a lot of people are calling for Kane to play less or in a different role. And Sterling obviously has got goals, but times has looked a little bit unclear as to what his role is in the system and so on. But after all of that, it's sort of U-turned, I think, in Germany and Ukraine. And now people are saying, look at Gareth Southgate's plan. Wasn't the squad rotation excellent? And it puts us in a position where we've suddenly seen England's depth. And that does mean that if the odd name is missing, there's lots of options. And I suppose we knew that that was always the case on paper, even before we came into the tournament. But a number of players have kind of stepped up either from a starting lineup perspective or off the bench. But now there's genuine selection headaches. So what do you do, in your opinion, if you're Gareth Southgate against Denmark in the second semi-final? Because yes, it was impressive against Ukraine, but by the same token, it's Ukraine and England were expected to win. So do you go back to the kind of Germany lineup? Do you go back to the 11 that you put out in the first game, or do you just keep the momentum going? Because I think of all the starting 11s I've seen, even though Ukraine were weaker opposition than Germany, this is the 11 I've liked the most.
I think there was like an online campaign for Sancho to play. I think it's very interesting that he has only played now that he's wrapped up his Manchester United deal. And I don't know whether it's I don't know whether Southgate thought he was distracted by that. I remember Southgate made a big thing at the start of the tournament about Harry Kane and the links with Man City, and basically saying, put all the transfer talk behind you until after the tournament, and then you can deal with it. And I just wonder, was Sancho maybe being not punished, but the fact that his move was progressing while he was with the England squad, I wonder whether he was basically just held back for that reason. I'm not sure what it was, but there was certainly the two are intrinsically linked. It seemed he wasn't playing, and because the deal was going ahead, so it was interesting. As for what England do from here, it's kind of tough. I still think Sterling's England's most important player, because I think without Sterling, they don't really look that dangerous. Like, I see his pace and the way he runs in behind, and his just movement in general is the one thing that creates space whenever they're facing like a difficult block to break down. I think once you get an early goal in a game, it changes things and it makes it much easier to do that. And so blowing Ukraine away once you get a goal inside the first couple of minutes, it's a good scoreline, but maybe it doesn't give you a good idea of how good England are at doing that. And whether the Czech Republic and the Scotland games and the Croatia games are all a better example of how England would struggle against a team if that had to like break them down. Like if they were to go a goal behind against Italy, what would that look like? If they went to goal down against Denmark, what would that look like? I don't know the answers to this because England haven't gone behind yet in a game. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's good, obviously, that you're not going behind in games because then you're never going to lose. It's a bad thing because you have lots of questions. You don't know the answers to yet. From an analysis point of view. Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at with England.
England, of course, haven't conceded in this Euros, as you say, but I still think, even though I might sound a bit overcritical, that that is the weakness. Pickford, as I said right at the beginning of this podcast, we saw one flash that exposes his vulnerability. Although again, you can look at it both ways because it was a long ball over the top. And I think his positional sense was actually very strong, but then he kind of swiped at the ball in a panic and his body position was all wrong, even though the initial timing to get to the ball was all right. And that's kind of my worry. And that's my concern about England. A little bit like what you were saying, Stephen, that when you play against either stronger opposition or in tighter games, and I think Denmark in the semi-final falls into the latter category. And I think Italy and Spain, if we get to the final, falls into the former category. And when you're in those games, there's a real danger, not just that a game is decided upon quality, which is that cliche that is always spoken about, but in a pressurized situation that a tight game is also decided based upon an error. And that is my big exclamation mark or question mark around England. You look through the whole squad and you say, yes, Maguire and the back line can protect Pickford. And you say, yes, there's a range of interchangeable options in midfield. And you say, yes, there's a world-class striker in Kane. And you say, yes, Sterling can play behind him with a range of other people. But Pickford, for me, could let the side down in a tight game. And I know that sounds a bit doom and gloom, and I know that sounds a little bit hypercritical, but it's fine margins, and fine margin games are not only decided by bits of quality, they can also be determined based upon mistakes as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we mentioned about previous podcasts, is the Italy game versus Austria, for example. There was a feeling that if that Austria goal had counted, Italy probably might have won out, because it just would have changed the dynamic of the game. They were already struggling, and then to go a goal behind, it's like, how do they dig themselves out from here? And we've seen that again with a few of the big teams in this tournament that have gone out because they've conceded a silly goal, or they've fell behind in the game and just couldn't fix the problem. And we haven't seen that yet from England. And whether that's not a problem for England or a problem we just haven't seen yet, we don't know. I thought the same thing watching Walker this game. I thought it genuinely looked like Walker and Stones had never played together before. They just didn't seem to have any chemistry at all. There was a moment in the second half where one of them was going to challenge for a ball and the other one was going to challenge for it as well. And then they both kind of just left it and it bounced over both of them. And then the ball was in behind the pair of them. And it was just like, it's just really strange to see it, because the reason they're together on one side and Maguire and Shaw is together on the other side is to have that sort of understanding from club level that's so important to build on as a defence. You need that sort of consistency and knowing you're like a partnership at the back. And it's just really, really strange to see how bad Walker and Stones were today in terms of that understanding. There's a moment where Stones drilled a ball across the pitch, just went straight out for a throw-in, because him and Shaw don't have that understanding. The moment where Walker tried to roll the ball back to Stones and it just got intercepted by Ukraine, you just think like a better forward would probably do something there with it, but it didn't really result in anything. And is that thing of there's mistakes in some of these players and they haven't cost England anything yet. It doesn't mean the problem isn't there. It just means hasn't really surfaced yet, I guess. And Pickford's the exact same thing. He has that ability to just fall to pieces in a game and have a bad moment, and it just sort of cascade into a bad performance. And we haven't seen it yet, and hopefully for England's sake you don't, but the worry was there today when he came running out and just missed the ball completely. And whether that plays on his mind or not going into the next game, you don't know. But yeah, that would be the worry for England, is just that ability to make a mistake and go behind in a game and then not have the tools to solve.
I do think that we're right to get carried away. And that doesn't mean that the dressing room will. And I think Gareth Southgate's been grounded all tournaments. And I've liked the way that he's led by example as a tactician and manager, but also just as a person in setting the tone. So I think the England players having left England at the Olympico, and that's sort of useful to get out of the media circus, especially straight after Germany, but then to come back to Wembley for the semis and the final, it will obviously be a bit of a pressure cooker. There'll be huge media attention. There'll be more fans inside Wembley. And I think everyone just feels like it is England's year, at least to get to the final anyway. It's a different proposition, obviously, if it's England against Italy or Spain. But the reason why I think that it's understandable that people are getting carried away, even if the players are just looking game by game. And Harry Maguire in his post-match interview was very level-headed, was very clear to put that message out there that England are not looking too far ahead and haven't been since beating Germany. But by the same token, the media and the fans will obviously have high expectations. And I think those high expectations are not, in this case, exaggerated. And the reason for that, I don't know whether you agree or disagree, is one, we are still building off that generation and progress from the last World Cup, where England obviously reached the semi-finals and lost to Croatia, and they'll have learned a lot from that game, and it will be a factor in terms of leveling heads and making sure that England are not complacent. But I just think the other reason why it isn't hyperbole necessarily to have these high expectations is simply because after beating Germany, the quality of opposition that England are up against on this side of the draw is just lower than from the other side of the draw. So even though you should never do this in football, if you are just judging games based upon paper, England should ultimately get to the final. Denmark are a wild card because they were superb in qualifying, and now they've had this tragic but emotional backstory that spurred them on. And thankfully, because Christian Eriksen is stable and making good progress and okay, they can use all of that to their advantage. But I still think England are at home, Denmark are coming from sweltering conditions in Azerbaijan, and for them, I feel it could just be one game too far. So it's kind of a weird situation, because sometimes we go into major tournaments and we overhype things, and then we could have just gone out to Germany and everyone would have said, oh yeah, England, they were very average. They didn't score that many goals. They were really poor against Scotland. They went out against Germany, and that was kind of scenario one. But now, having beaten Germany, we should be winning these games. We always should have beaten Ukraine. The performance was great. It was a joy to watch. They were professional. They were mature. They were organized. They played with a smile on their face. But we should be winning that game. So we've not really learned that much more about England. And even if we beat Denmark, we should be winning that game, especially at Wembley Stadium. So we can be in a slightly bizarre situation. And I think we said this, didn't we, about Italy before the tournament as well, about how they'd won a string of games, they'd kept a string of clean sheets, but had they really been tested? But now Italy have been tested. Spain have been tested throughout the whole tournament. England, for parts of certain games, have been tested, a little bit against Germany, second half against the Czech Republic, 90 minutes against Scotland, but not really tested in a pressurized situation, because even against Scotland, they'd obviously still come off the back of a win against Croatia. So even if they lost that game, the consequences weren't going to be dire. So I suppose my question to you, in light of that opinion, is just, are these expectations, even though we're all very excitable, just normal because of the quality of opposition that England have faced so far? Or are we already exaggerating England's chances, which might prove, because of that hype, to be to England's detriment?
Yeah, I mean, there's many parts of this. Basically, belief's important. And as for fans, you need to believe in your team. And without that, you don't really have anything. You can't really get behind your team if you think when they go behind, they're probably going to lose. If you go into the Germany match thinking probably going to lose and you don't get behind the team, then you probably lose. And the players feel it, I think. I think that's what we've seen this year without fans in the stadium as well, when teams have struggled to dig themselves out of bad situations because there's no one behind them. It almost feels like a training match, and it doesn't matter, and the result doesn't matter as much. But you didn't really see many epic games without fans in the stadium, and I think that plays into it. And I think that's the importance of having the rest of the games at Wembley for England, is they're going to have those fans behind them. And that's really, really important. And whether it's hype or belief or exaggerated expectations, it doesn't really matter. As long as the fans get behind the team, you've just two games to win, and one of them's a really beatable team in Denmark, and the other one's going to be a really tough game. But it's a game you can win. Anything can happen in a one-off game, and ultimately, if England sit behind the ball, are hard to break down and can hold on, and then nick a goal on the counter, it doesn't matter. I see no real problem in it. I always thought the expectation and the hype on the England team from the media in the past was toxic. I didn't think it was beneficial in the way that in the way it was being done. But this is different. It's the expectations is coming from the fact that England are actually doing well and they're actually progressing and they have an easy route to the final. I don't see any harm in it. I'm all for it, actually. That's exactly the way you should support your team. It's painful for me as a non-England fan and to sort of deal with it, but that's exactly how you should go into these tournaments. I also think the thing about travel is important as well. There's loads of studies in travel and sports, and it's important to have proper rest after games, and having to like travel from one part of Europe to another, side to side, up and down, different climates, it's not great. And England have been fairly steady for the whole tournament, whereas most of the other teams have had to ship around all over Europe for games. And I think that's just another one of those little advantages that all sort of pay into it. Being able to just be consistent and staying in your home base and playing in front of your own fans, it's all advantages that England have. And so, yeah, every reason to be optimistic.
Well, I think if we discount the semi-finals and the final, all four semi-finalists have had a home advantage. I mean, Denmark started in Copenhagen. Italy obviously played their group games at the Olympico. Spain as well haven't had that much travel. And yeah, I suppose you could say, well, Denmark went to Azerbaijan and the conditions required some acclimatization. But England also traveled to the Olympico and that added a sort of wild card aspect to this particular fixture. Although it was obvious that inside the Olympico, it was still heavily predominant England fans. So anyway, England are through to the semi-finals and they'll play Denmark. And Denmark played earlier in the day and they beat the Czech Republic by 2-1. Both of these sides, for various different reasons, have been really great to watch. Czech Republic and Schick have been a surprise package. Denmark, prior to the worrying and sad incident with Christian Eriksen in the opening match, were a lot of people's dark horses, myself included. And despite that particular incident that unfortunately befell Eriksen, Denmark have bounced back. And it's incredible, the turnaround, really, isn't it? Having lost that first group game to Finland, and you sort of felt like the draining experience and the trauma of Eriksen's collapse would essentially knock them out of the tournament. And since then, they've not only recovered, but they've got better and better in every game.
Yeah, I think most people have just psychologically written them off because, I mean, not only is the event, but it's the fact that Eriksen's their best player, and sort of it's the expectation that, well, you're without your best player, and also the event that had happened in was very traumatic and very draining emotionally, and so you just didn't think they would have much left in the rest of the tournament, but they've been magnificent, and I think it's actually had the opposite effect where everyone's now behind Denmark. And I think they feel that. And they're just playing with so much energy and confidence. They looked exhausted towards the end of that Czech game, but that's to be expected given the amount of work they've had to put in to get where they are in the tournament. But yeah, they were really impressive once again. I think it was interesting as well that the two goals we saw from Italy the other day, it was having to move the ball to get it into positions to score goals. Whereas all three goals today in that Denmark-Czech game were like first-time finishes. And it's just interesting, that thing. I think we had a conversation on our WhatsApp group with Marius just about how much easier it is from a technical level to create chances like that for like first-time finishes, just from like crosses or passes where you're basically just playing the ball into space, someone runs onto it and hits it. Whereas having to like dribble the way Barella did, that's a lot harder skill. And so it's interesting that you see goals like that in the game for the Czechs and the Denmark. And maybe we're going to see similar goals in England versus Denmark, where we'll see like crosses, set pieces, like we did today for England and for Denmark's first goal today. So yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I mean, you say sort of maybe we'll see crosses and a lot of chances and ultimately goals, but the recent meetings between England and Denmark have been tight. I mean, let's not forget October 2020, last meeting in the Nations League, and Denmark won that by 1-0. The other Nations League match was 0-0. They've played a few friendlies over the last couple of decades where England have got the better, but narrowly. And the last big victory was 2005, and that was a Denmark victory by 4-1. So, you know, you can kind of go back further. And obviously we know the Denmark team in 1992 won the Euros. We know that England had a good record. You know, you could look at the 50s if you're looking at head-to-heads. They played in the World Cup there and England won both of those games comfortably. They played in the 2002 World Cup and England won that game comfortably as well by 3-0. But, you know, you can bring up that history for Germany because it adds to the narrative. But if we're looking for evidence of how this semi-final might pan out, you only really want to look back 5-6 years Otherwise, it's a completely different generation. And these generations of players, and there's sort of a contrast in some senses, because Denmark are quite inexperienced, quite a cohesive unit. They've rebuilt since 92. They had a dip in form. And then as they qualified for this tournament, they kind of came back with a vengeance, with solid defending, with a lot of width, with a lot of movement, strong from set pieces, scored a lot of goals. And that was why they were dark horses. And then England, on the other hand, are a bit of a kind of newer side, a bit more fluid, a bit more depth, a bit more versatility. But when they've met, Denmark have had the edge of late. As I say, England haven't scored in the last two meetings against them, both in 2020. Previous meeting was in March 2014. England won that one, but only by a goal to nil. So if recent evidence with players that have actually come up against each other between these two teams in recent international history is anything to go by, it is going to be a very, very tight game.
Yeah, I think it's weird if they switch roles where I'm the more positive one. But just sort of trying to stay optimistic about it. I think if England are going to do well in the tournament, you're going to have to do away with all of these past meeting history things. And that's kind of what we saw with Germany game, where everyone's saying, well, England haven't won against Germany and Wembley since like 1975. And so you need to... You need to make your own history, I guess. And I remember that was a big deal for Liverpool whenever they hadn't won the league in like 30 years. And it was a big mantra of we need to write our own history. And also that whole we need to take one game at a time thing. I think it's interesting that Henderson has a big leadership role as well for this England team. And I'm pretty sure they just have the same mantra of history doesn't matter. You need to make your own history. They weren't involved in it. So I'm hoping that for the game, from a neutral point of view, it'll be a lot more open than the past ones. Then again, you're probably right, and it'll probably be a dour game, 0-0. And it'll be stolen by the odd goal from one of the two teams.
I think for me, from Denmark's point of view, just so people listening don't think that we're too kind of Anglo-centric, because we've covered England in quite a lot of depth. In the absence of Eriksen, you're right, he's their best player. The two Kaspers for me are really important. Kasper Dolberg, who for me anyway, was man of the match in the 2-1 victory over the Czech Republic and got on the score sheet. And then Kasper Schmeichel as well. Of course, you can make a case too for Simon Kjær, who's had an excellent tournament as well. But I think the Kasper Schmeichel and Kasper Dolberg are going to be two key players for Denmark. And they've always struck me both domestically and internationally as big occasion players.
Yeah, I think Schmeichel's Superman save with that sort of dive and punch today, that was a proper highlight, real moment in your career. It just looked great, like aesthetically great save. But yeah, he's an important player for them. I think Poulsen as well. I think we saw today the strength of Poulsen in the team. At one point in the game, he's playing centre forward. He popped up at like right back in his own box, winning a 1v1 before setting off a counter-attack. And it's really rare to see that from a forward player, that desire to like work all the way back into your own box to defend. But that's what he does. He has that mentality of basically it's a team effort defending, and he's the first man in the defence. So he'll chase players the length of the pitch to defend. It's his work ethic's phenomenal. And you see that a lot at Leipzig as well. And I think him and Kasper Dolberg are important players for them in attack, and have been phenomenal the last two games. Dolberg has been, and Poulsen was today. I also thought it was very interesting that Denmark are famed for set pieces, but they only actually created one chance from a set piece today, and it turned out to be a goal. But I'd also said the same thing about England previously. England are renowned for their set pieces, and that was deemed a big threat from England going into the tournament. But up until today, they were one of the lowest ranked teams in terms of set pieces in the tournament, and then they scored two today. So I keep coming back to set pieces, but I kind of skip the idea that that's where this game is probably going to be won and lost. It's probably going to be on a set piece.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be an emotional semi-final, though. I do think, even though we've tried to give balance, and maybe even on my part as a proud Englishman, an element of realism, or some might say pessimism, I still think that England will win. I'm not sure they'll keep a clean sheet, but I can see England winning by 2-1. I also think that the Wembley crowd will pay their respects to this Denmark story, and of course Christian Eriksen. There will be loads of Tottenham fans because of the location of Wembley Stadium, and Spurs played at Wembley, that may either be inside or in the vicinity. And I just think we're going to see one of those games, even though it's high intensity, even though it's high stakes, I think we're going to see one of those games where both sets of fans have kind of a sense of unity and camaraderie and festival atmosphere, which is not always what you would traditionally say about a semi-final of this magnitude. But I just think because of the circumstances that have taken Denmark this far, whether it's pre-match, whether it's during the match, after 10 minutes to award Eriksen 10 a round of applause, or whether it is just at full time, I think we're going to see football in its best light in the build-up, in the 90 minutes and at full time, really regardless of the result.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the hope. It always in the back of my mind that every group of people has its idiots and every fan base has its idiots. And it just takes a few of them to turn whatever positive atmosphere there is into something that isn't. And I think that's what we saw after the Germany game, where you had that whole thing with the little girl crying and people being abusive towards her online. And it's just a handful of idiots, and it isn't a big deal. But it feels like it is, because they're also the loudest part of your fan base, the very vocal minority, I guess. And I think that's a reflection on society as well. So we all hope that everyone comes to it with the right attitude and the right intentions to have a good positive game, and I'm sure it will be. But yeah, I just have it in the back of my mind and worry that every group has the possibility of going in the wrong direction. You just hope it doesn't happen.
Just a final word on the other semi-final. I know we'll come on to this in other podcasts, and we have of course covered those games before because they happened prior to the two matches today. But Spain against Italy, Stephen, how do you see that one panning out?
I hate to agree with Ollie often, but he said from the start that Italy would do well. And I remember whenever we had a conversation in the preview, and I said Italy might surprise people to have good players. They have a very well-balanced team, and balance is so important in football. And Italy have sort of been the team that surprised people, in the sense that they look like probably the best team in the competition from the first game. And I've also been the person defending Spain on here, basically saying they can't keep missing chances. If you're creating chances, you're going to score goals. And Spain create a lot of chances. But we're now with two games left, and that whole, it has to happen at some point. But, I mean, we're running out of time. So, I mean, they need to get it right in this game or the next, or otherwise they're in trouble. So it's probably advantage Italy, but I honestly wouldn't be surprised to see Spain blow them away either. It's one of those games where it's probably the first goal is all that matters. As often as in big games. That I would say it's probably advantage Italy, but anything could happen, really.
Yeah, it's a strange dynamic, isn't it? Because actually Spain came into the tournament with such low-key expectations, at least outside of their camp, and a lot of people within the camp said that they wanted it that way. And they've kind of got far enough now that whatever happens against arguably the favourites to win the whole tournament, they're not going to come in for a lot of criticism. They've got a lot less to lose. They can play with a bit more freedom, perhaps. Whereas the pressure, I think, is suddenly on Italy, because Mancini, almost a bit like Southgate in some ways, wants to kind of both win, but also banish his own history. So we all know about Southgate's history with the Euros in England, but Mancini never really did what he should have done for the Italian national team through a mixture of form, personality, and fallouts. And you can kind of tell with both Southgate and Mancini that this tournament is very, very personal to them. And of course, it's become very personal to Denmark. But if you take out the actual Eriksen incident and you just look at how far a team has come based upon their squad and based upon merit, you could make an argument that Denmark and Spain have actually got very little to lose at this point, whereas there's huge pressure on England because effectively now they're the hosts, and there's massive pressure on Italy because effectively now they're the favourites.
Yeah, how you manage that pressure is very important. I think you can turn it into a positive or a negative. It's the same with fear. Soldiers turn fear into a positive. That it's what fires them up and makes them react to things that are threats. And it's the same. That's what I look at anything like pressure in football as well. It depends how well grounded you are and how prepared you are for it. Given what we've seen from Denmark, they look phenomenally well prepared to take everything in their stride. England have taken everything in their stride so far in the tournament. I still have that itching feeling about, I haven't seen them go behind yet, and I don't know how to respond to that. And that, I kind of want it to happen before the final, because England need to have an answer to that question. They need to, if England were to go to behind in this game and then come back and win it, it would answer so many questions about England. But the same's probably true for Spain as well. Spain probably needs someone to rock them and to come through it, because they've sort of walked through a lot of teams in the group stages, and then in the knockouts, while they were sort of pressured at times, they were never behind and really struggling. And I kind of want to see at least struggle at some point. Spain, you just want to see them score goals. You just want you want their forwards to click, because they haven't yet. Moreno and Morata just don't look like they know how to score. It's really weird. So yeah, all the teams have their own questions over them. And it's sort of interesting, because we looked at the group of death before the tournament started, but the group of death, just they all went out as soon as they got a knockout game. We were so sure that a winner, or at least a finalist, would come from the group of death, and it just hasn't happened. So it's very interesting how that teams deal with that pressure. I don't know whether getting out of the group of death, it was like, oof, okay, we can relax now, and then that's it, they're out. But yeah, it must be a big psychological thing there.
Absolutely, it's a really good point, and two intriguing semi-finals to come. Stephen, always great catching up, and look forward to hearing from you throughout the rest of the tournament.
Thanks very much, Ben.
Stephen Drennan and myself, Ben Jacobs, that's it for now. Keep following us. We will have plenty of build-up and reaction to the two semi-finals, England against Denmark at Wembley Stadium, and before that, Spain against Italy. Four cracking teams, two intriguing lineups as Euro 2020 reaches its business end.
Big thanks to Ben and Stephen there to breaking down the action straight after the game. Of course, you can stay abreast with everything going on here at Why Football Happens by following us on Twitter at @podcast_WFH. That's @podcast_WFH. And like, subscribe, rate and review the podcast on anchor.fm, our host, and all good podcasting outlets, including iTunes and Spotify, to stay up to date with everything that we're doing here at Why Football Happens. So the Euro semi-finals are set. We'll have more action and reaction coming through the end of the tournament. Until then, it's goodbye for now.